A wide man, smelling hard of mechanic's grease, dived over an overturned table at Grant in a flying head-high tackle. Grant reached out for him, touched him with his big, hard hands, and then, pivoting around his body centerline, simply steered the hurtling body past. The mechanic flew into a knot of men bashing ineffectually at each other with beer bottles.
Huh. That stuff Sifu Chen taught me in Nuedo is the real deal.
Kane blocked a blow from a cudgel that might have been a wrenched-off table leg with his right forearm. His assailant, a gap-toothed man with a deep scar crossing one milky dead eye, looked surprised when his makeshift club made a distinct clacking sound. Instead of striking unprotected bone, the stick had hit the metal-reinforced power holster holding Kane's concealed sin-eater. As the dead-eyed man gaped, Kane whipped his shin up into his groin. Foul breath oofed over Kane, and spittle sprayed his face. The attacker doubled over. Kane straightened him back up with an uppercutting elbow beneath the chin. The man went over backward in a boneless flail of limbs, stunned senseless. Kane wiped his face. Bridget crouched at his side. Clutched in her fist was a nasty little knife with a single-edged triangular blade, no more than 4 inches long. Her own erstwhile opponent still lay stunned and stretched out in the sawdust on the floor. Bridget's punch had catalyzed a volatile reaction in the Gaudy. Resentment and anger never lay far from the surface in the Tartarus pits, so it took very little to trigger explosive violence. The outbreak's sudden fury was random, not directed against the undercover trio, except incidentally. Indeed, for a moment, they found themselves in the quiet eye of the storm that raged about them.
Way to keep a low profile, Baptiste.
I thought I had to do that, to maintain credibility.
And that was the only reason?
Before she could answer, a weight landed on Kane's shoulders from behind. It was the dwarf with the hank of wild black hair. He clamped his legs beneath Kane's armpits and began belaboring his head with blows from his stubby arm. Kane whacked at him. The half-sized man avoided his swings with surprising alacrity. Kane was operating under severe constraints. Despite Kane's determination not to do so, he committed the low comedy error of punching himself in the head. The dwarf grabbed handfuls of Kane's cheeks and brought his mouth close to Kane's right ear.
Fall down, schmuck.
In your dreams.
You want to see Orion or don't you? You're cold, Daddy Longlegs.
Kane let himself fall to his knees as quickly as he could without banging them on the mostly smooth-worn planking. Then he tugged the sleeve of Bridget, who was already staring at him as if he'd sprouted antlers.
Who are you, midget?
Dwarf. Call me Hanred. I'm supposed to take you to the boss. Since you blew the covert approach all the fucking gone, our best bet is to shag ass out of here while this fracas is going undercover for us.
A large black man-mountain was engaged with Grant. He didn't look very happy. Grant had his left hand twisted around and back upon itself, which had the effect of straightening his arm and locking out the elbow, leaving the larger man helpless and bereft of options. Grant glanced down to see his partner and the covert redhead crouched next to the dwarf, all staring at him from the vicinity of the floor.
Kane? What the hell are you doing?
Get down here.
Grant shrugged, put his free palm on the other man's locked elbow, and spun, running his victim headfirst into the wall, hard. The man's eyes rolled up in his head, and his knees buckled. Keeping a weather eye on him in case he was faking, Grant crouched beside his partners. The quartet was now more or less sheltered from the chaos in the lee of their corner table.
What's the joke, Kane?
You're enjoying that Kin Na stuff way too much.
It works. Add some spice to the old mag rough-and-tumble style we're both used to. You got down here with a projectile midget, tell me that.
I'm a dwarf, you schmucks, not a midget. Midgets are proportioned same as you big pukes.
Whatever.
Now what?
You walk around back behind the bar. Go through the beaded curtain.
What about you?
I'll catch up with you. Right now, I'm going to stir the pot a little. Make sure it keeps turning over long enough for you three to scram.
He slid off Kane's back and waddled out among the forested legs. The brawl seemed to be settling down of its own accord. Hanratty made for the biggest man still standing, a redhead with an HVAC technician's badge on his stained jumpsuit.
All right, who wants some?
Hanratty caught up to Grant, Kane, and Bridget as they hurried down a slimy-walled passageway. He'd emerged from the renewed ruction miraculously unscathed, obviously a well-tuned talent.
I can't believe you, of all people, started a bar brawl, Bridget.
Hanratty led the way, bearing a pine-knot torch that streamed orange flame and a thin black drool of smoke and stank vigorously of kerosene.
I had to stay in character, as Kane kept reminding me. And Kane, I still owe you for that crack on the backside. Don't think I've forgotten.
We never, ever forget you've got an eidetic memory, Baptiste. As you never tire of reminding us.
Can the chatter, Meshuggahnas? We don't exactly want to advertise the presence of this secret passage. Notice that word, secret?
The passage continued down and down. The walls sweated. Grant gave them a jaundiced look.
I don't like seeing all this moisture. We're pretty far down and close enough to the lake that a little tremor might make it want to come in and visit us.
Hasn't so far.
I'm curious, Hanratty. You appear to be accepted, yet generally throughout the Outlands. Little people are suspected of being muties.
Little people? Little people? Jeez, what's wrong with you? I'm a dwarf, not a friggin' leprechaun. Are you trying to make me feel better? You figure, well, the world got blown up and turned to shit. Everything's run by a bunch of fascist megalomaniacs in these dippy castles. But I'll feel all better if you avoid calling attention to my affliction.
I'll hold him if you want to hit him, Baptiste.
Kane! I apologize if I have offended you.
He waved a hand on a stumpy arm.
Never mind. I'm Orion's factotum, you might say. The pit boss's strong but sneaky left hand. People don't fuck with me for the good and sufficient reason that if they do, they get fucked back harder. That enough answer for you, Red?
Reflexively, Bridget raised a hand to her bandana from concern a lock of hair might have slipped its surly bonds. Then she realized she'd dyed it anyway. Grant stopped.
Not so fast there, Shorty. Why'd you call her Red?
What else would I call the famous, or should I say notorious, Bridget Baptiste, Grant?
So this is what your modern-day Baron Blasters look like. Suitably disguised, of course.
It was a little half-bubble of concrete deep below the earth. Its walls were covered with bizarre machine-made tapestries of snarling tigers and dogs playing cards. Kane guessed it was part of an ancient fallout shelter, the private mini-redoubts that enjoyed a certain popularity in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Unfortunately, they had gone out of fashion, with the result that most of them were filled in or just lost by the time the nuke cost came, when they might have done some good. Maureen Orion dominated the little chamber by sheer bulk alone. She had to have stood well over 6 feet tall and weighed well over 400 pounds, much of it fat. It was stuffed into black velvet pantaloons and a stained white blouse with puffy sleeves. Her bodice was tight, although it would have been hard for it not to be, given what it had to contend with, and it was cut way too low for Kane's peace of mind. The face on the front of her beer keg head was so heavily painted that it didn't actually have to have any physical features at all, although she did seem to possess the normal ones in relatively standard arrangement. Hair of a color that was almost a metallic magenta was piled high atop her head. The color owed more to chemistry than genes, unless she had more than a bit of muti to her.
How did you happen to recognize us?
The four of them sat around a large round table topped with worn and stained green baize. The pit boss had been playing what looked like a game of solitaire with a tarot deck when Hanratty, who now stood back against the wall, escorted the visitors within. Basically, Orion occupied one half of the table, the three outsiders the other, and all three felt themselves collectively outmassed. On the basis of sheer size alone, she invited comparison to the late and markedly unlamented boss of the Cobaltville pit, Guana Teague. Making much, anything, of that would be a grave mistake, Kane judged. The Palladiumville boss was, if anything, bigger than Teague had been. She also struck Kane as far smarter and definitely more aware. That was the best word he could put to it. Consequently, he judged her to be far more dangerous.
Your boss Lakesh got word to me he wanted to make talk. Our channels aren't the sort to allow exchange of much information, not safely or reliably, which meant he'd be sending agents for a face-to-face. Even the barons, who've got more brains than they have any notion what to do with, and generally display about the sense of a 4-week-old kitten, know that the three top operators for the resistance on this continent are three renegades from Cobaltville. So when a tall drink of water with a wolf's eyes, or eye, an even bigger black cold heart, and a prissy librarian type with a truly outstanding rack turn up in my dive, what conclusion am I supposed to draw?
Kane managed to maintain an impassive expression, but not without superhuman effort. Grant, who had started to build up major thunderheads at hearing Lakesh termed their boss, ground his teeth. Brigid turned red, but her thoughts about being characterized as a prissy librarian type remained unvoiced behind her archivist's well-trained poker face.
I won't blow smoke up your butts.
Maureen Orion did, however, blow smoke out of her heavily painted lips toward the low ceiling of her headquarters. She stuck the end of her carved ebony cigarette holder back in her mouth and toked deeply of her ditchweed joint.
I deal with those above as well as those below. But ease up there, boys. Don't go forming up your fists to summon forth the sin-eaters you undoubtedly have strapped beneath those loose sleeves of yours.
If we're who you say we are, why shouldn't we?
I guess it depends on how badly you want to waste all the trouble you took getting here. Not to mention your chances of getting back into our Midwestern winter sunshine, such as it is alive. If I was going to shop you or scrag you, would I have gone to this much trouble?
Would you? Never known a pit boss who wouldn't sell his mother if the price was right.
Maybe if we asked her directly what she meant, she might actually tell us.
Forgive my mirth. It's just that my dear mother sold me to outland slavers when I was 4. She was the pit boss of Tartarus, and I came back to supplant her. But I didn't sell her. No, indeed. Although she would have much preferred that, I suspect. As for your question, sweetie, the answer is simple. Corruption. That's how I know everything that goes on up there. Actually, it's just business as usual. That's another trap, that word corruption. It doesn't mean what most people think it means. The barons and their little scam are no worse than any government throughout history, in that they're all about enslaving the human race and always have been. The kind of corruption that gets the ruler's panties in a wad is when one of them gets a little too greedy, risks giving the whole game away by grabbing at too much, makes it too obvious what's really going on. Alternately, it's when their greed leads them to make deals with us marks to cut us some slack. This has the effect of cutting into the pies of the rest of the power structure. A definite no-no.
I admit I am a bit confused here, Ms. Orion. Which kind of corruption led to your discovering our identities, our existence?
You pick! You wondered earlier what my price was. Fair enough. But you'd get a lot more out of wondering what their price is. Anybody in government is always on the take for power and wealth. That's the only reason they're in government. The only reason for government. Only reason there's ever been. And there's no loyalty among them. No government is ever anybody's friend. Nobody in government is either.
That seems like a sweeping statement.
Kane, you were in government. All 3 of you were, right?
Right. And it was just exactly Kane's damn fool notions of friendship that...
Exactly. When feelings of authentic friendship cropped up, what choice did you have to make?
She's got you there, partner. Might as well yield gracefully, no matter how badly against the grain it goes.
Kane turned his icy gray gaze back to Orion, shifting his patch up to his forehead to return normal vision to his eyes. Not that he needed a lot of depth perception in viewing the mountainous pit boss.
How do we know we can trust you?
You don't. Evidently, your friend Lakesh trusted me enough to send you here.
Which is to say, Lakesh trusted our ability to get out of here alive. At least we hope so.
What is your price, then?
So the cloistered senior archivist has learned practicality in her years as a renegade and refugee? It shouldn't surprise me, I suppose. You must have been a quick study for Lakesh to make you his protege. Don't look so surprised. Despite the growing friction among the baronies, Cobaltville's magistrate division shared substantial intel on the 3 of you with the other 8, and so it came to me.
Kane glanced at Grant. Unless she actually was blowing Mary Jane smoke up their butts, the rot within the Palladiumville Mag Division, and possibly its trust, ran far wider and deeper than it ever had within Cobaltville. There had been covert dealings between the magistrates and Guana Teague, to be sure, but they were more in the nature of the dealings between a puppet master and his marionette.
And the price for telling us what we want to know?
You know, Red, I like you. I like you all. Each and every one of you have that go-to-hell look in your eyes, even if they're all of different shades. Maybe the price should be a turn in the rack with all three of you at once.
Fortunately, Grant's scowl was already at maximum depth. If it got any deeper, his head would implode. Kane felt his own face turn to steel, although his stomach did some turning of a different kind. Bridget paled.
I can tell by the looks on your faces you're none too thrilled by that offer. Too bad. I'd rock your world. I know some tricks that would, but never mind.
She leaned forward again. Her imposing frontage got caught on the edge of the decayed card table, and the billow of white flesh exposed by the plunge of her neckline swelled ominously.
I'll tell you what you can do for me. You can destroy the bastards!
Even Kane recoiled from her sudden vehemence.
Who?
The barons, their goons and toadies, and whoever it is behind them who helped set them up and who props them up today. I want them pulled down, smashed, completely and utterly chilled. And I want to watch it happen before I die.
I don't quite see what you want from us.
That you continue doing what you're doing until you win. So you see, I'm asking a very high price indeed.
Oh, we'll pay. It's not as if we have much choice.
She nodded briskly, causing the pile of brilliant hair atop her head to wobble dangerously. In a few succinct words, she recounted what had happened upstairs in the monolith. The intrusion, the fatal battle between mags and intruders armed with wonder blasters, the literal post-mortem, and its still tentative conclusions. She plunged two fingers into the tight crack between her ponderous breasts and brought forth a pearl-shiny disc.
Oh, here's a copy of the files on the incident. All the reports and intel analysis.
She tossed it onto the faded and worn green baize as if dealing a card. Kane eyed it with distaste, he found hard to conceal. Giving him a men-are-such-babies glare, Bridget leaned forward, picked it up, and stuffed it into her own bodice.
What we really came to find out was how your mystery intruders got in and out.
Easy. They didn't.
I beg your pardon?
I don't see everything that goes on in the whole ville. The maggots don't see everything that goes on in the ville. Put us together, though, and you've got pretty complete coverage. If you look on the disc tucked away between your pretty titties, girlie, you will learn that the mag's own vidcams showed no movement or activity in the corridors leading to the storeroom. Nobody was detected approaching any of the spaces bordering the room's six sides, nor was there any sign of entry being forced through wall, floor, or ceiling, as well as the door. As you're well aware, the HVAC ducting in the monolith and enclaves is too small to pass anybody larger than a human child. Even Hanratty wouldn't fit, with that chest of his. Vents weren't tampered with. No signs of motion picked up by the sensors in the ducts themselves. There are fine layers of undisturbed dust on the floors of all ducts leading to the storage space, meaning no one as large as the woman they chilled had passed through by any means, including levitation.
But somebody got in.
And out. Unless dust bunnies came to life, chilled a bag of mags, and left an altogether human corpse behind.
Then how?
You'd know more about it than I would, wouldn't you? Some variation of those jump gateways you use.
Once again, Kane found the limits of his poker face being tested.
How do you know about that?
I got the official internal report on the incident upstairs, sweetie. I couldn't have the kind of access I have without knowing that the maggots have a way of hopping instantaneously among their castles and other places. Besides, everybody knows there's such a thing. The legends talk about the amazing ability to be suddenly in far apart locations without time to travel the intervening distance.
Kane looked at his companions. They were looking at him. His best guess was that the intruders had their own form of portable quantum interphase matter transmission inducer, just as he and his friends did. But he was damned if he was going to let on to that in front of this woman. Even if she was as friendly as she acted, what she didn't know she couldn't tell the magistrates, willingly or under duress. Orion spread her tarot deck face up on the table.
That's all I got, honeys.
This isn't part of our business. Maybe none of our business at all. But I long ago learned to be wary of dealing with people when I didn't know what they stood to gain from it. Or thought they did, which isn't always the same thing.
I told you, hard man, to bring down those above. The ones who squat on our backs, make us live like rats, tell us it's our fault, like it was us pressed the buttons and made the nuke cost happen, instead of the ones they took over from. Or maybe not. Maybe it was them all along. Either way, I want to watch them fall.
Perhaps Kane was wondering what actions you're taking to attain those ends. Corruption, you said. But to be candid, I'd like to know, too, how.
Easy! Wonder where the cigars come from? They're not scabby. People down in Beau Soleil grow the weed in secret patches. Mags can't find them, not all. Not that they necessarily try that hard. Everybody wants something, my friend. And it's not always what the ones in power want you to want, as you three demonstrate in your own ways, don't you now? If they're not interested in Jack, then sure as shit rolls downhill, they're interested in something Jack can buy. That price thing again. The profit from growing, chopping, curing, and rolling those smokes is enough to make people run risks, and enough to make sure they can provide whatever it is the magistrates in their area do want. The cigars come here in trader caravans. I swap them various things. My brew, mostly. Do they haul it all the way back down to the Carolinas? Generally not. They sell it off to thirsty scabby, say, who found things in the ruins of Chi-Town that the tobacco choppers down south want. Whatever. All I do is trade.
She smiled at them.
That's it?
Nothing more subversive. And believe me, I specialize in finding out what those above want that they're not supposed to get, and supplying it to them, in exchange for favors, goods, and services. And, of course, selective vision problems.
But isn't that dangerous?
You asked that question? The combat librarian? Anyways, I got a fatal disease. One nobody ever walks away from.
What's that?
Grant was suspicious. People weren't susceptible to contagion these days, by and large. Most of those who were had turned to dust without passing on their genes during Skydark and the years of struggle afterward. Most sickness today was caused by postnatal exposure to rads or toxins. But infectious diseases still did stalk the land, and those who caught them could be triple red danger zones.
What disease do you have?
Life!
She's got us there, partner. No one gets out alive.
Dunno. We've known some people lived an awful long time, from that fused-out Nazi Skorzeny to Lakesh.
He didn't mention they'd known beings other than human who had lived longer still, by orders of magnitude.
Which only means they've succeeded in cheating death so far. It's like gaming at a gaudy house. Even if the tables are honest, if you play long enough, the house always wins.
That's the spirit! Spoken like a true gaudy slut! You know how to throw yourself into your role, Bridget Baptiste!
Not too well, I hope.
The wooden door behind Orion suddenly jumped forward off its hinges. Two magistrates in full black hard contact armor burst into the little room, brandishing sin-eaters.
Hands on heads, scumbags! Do it now!
Kane, Grant, and Bridget passed a look around. The pit boss sat as if suddenly turned to a statue. Did Orion set us up? Kane wondered. Slowly, the Cerberus trio rose, hands obediently clamped to the sides of their heads. Faceless behind their red-tinted, slightly concave visors, the two Palladiumville mags tracked them with their hand blasters. When the three were almost upright, two things happened simultaneously. Without so much as twitching a muscle beforehand, Orion sloshed the pint of homebrew over her right shoulder into the faceplate of the magistrate on that side. And although no signal had passed between them, Hanratty the dwarf, who, despite his earlier outspokenness, had stood throughout the whole meeting so quietly against the wall that Kane forgot he was there, hurled himself at the legs of the other villain forcer. Grant dropped his big right hand, driving it into his pocket. Then he brought it up and forward. The front of his raggedy pant leg gave way as if it had been tacked by a few weak threads, as it had. A big gray Frunky Spass combat shotgun came with it. The mag who'd taken the brew to his visor had just slammed his faceplate up. Although his face was now vulnerable, Grant shot him in the chest. Under most circumstances, the thick, curved polycarbonate breastplate of full magistrate armor would shed either a full charge of buck or a rifled slug, but Grant had loaded his scattergun specifically for mag armor. It carried depleted uranium penetrators sleeved in plastic sabots that fell away when the projectile left the barrel. There was nothing ferrous in the magistrate carapace to activate the heat flash chemical reaction of a DU round, and the projectile's velocity was way too low anyway. But the pointed slug was incredibly dense and hard. It punched through the polycarb breastplate as if it were a pre-dark soft drink cup. The magistrate folded without ever triggering his blaster. The other fired a tri-burst as the dwarf flew at him. The little man struck him at the armored crotch, and his weight slammed the mag back against the wall. Blood squirted from Marina Ryan's pale bare skin as a round punched through her left shoulder just beneath the joint. Her vast mass sagged at her plush chair. Kane was already in motion, throwing Bridget toward the floor as he lunged for the magistrate. Off balance, with the dwarf's dead weight sprawled on his legs, keeping him tipped back against the wall beside the door, the mag triggered another tri-burst. Two rounds missed. They bounced off the far walls and went whining and keening through the cramped space, miraculously intersecting no live meat, though one whanged off the fallen mag's carapace.
Oh, fuck!
The third slammed into Kane's ribs 3 inches down and out from his left nipple. He closed with the magistrate. As tall as Kane and bulkier in his black armored suit, the man seemed stunned to find that his attacker had just capped a solid hit from a nine ball and was still coming. Kane grabbed the Sin-Eater's perforated barrel shroud with both hands and put his whole weight into torquing it inward. It slipped from the mag's fingers, pivoted off the base of his thumb, came away in Kane's hand. The magistrate lashed out with the hand from which the blaster had just been twisted. He caught Kane across the bearded face and sent him reeling face first against the wall. Unfortunately for him, Kane kept a firm grip on the Sin-Eater, ripping it loose from the rig strapped to the magistrate's forearm armor. Grant was swinging a shotgun to bear on the standing magistrate. Kicking aside the limp but bulky dwarf, the mag lunged toward Kane, intending to use him as a shield and try to reestablish control. The mag grabbed Kane's left arm and tried to crank it up in a hammerlock behind his back. Kane bent quickly forward, dropped the stolen blaster, and grabbed the smooth, slick armor behind the mag's right calf with his own right hand. He straightened quickly, yanking the mag's leg straight up between his own. The magistrate fell with a resounding crash. The thin rug, now sodden with blood, did little to cushion his fall. He let go of Kane's arm on the way down. Kane spun. He curled the fingers of his right hand. His own Sin-Eater ripped free of the sleeve of his shirt and slammed into his hand. As the fallen mag struggled to rise, Kane dropped astride his chest, thrust the muzzle of his blaster up under the red visor, and squeezed off a single shot. He stood. The Sin-Eater hissed back into its holster, and he turned to take stock of the situation. His companions were unscathed. The same couldn't be said for their hosts.
Hanratty!
Marina Ryan knelt in a tectonic movement at the side of Hanratty the dwarf, who still lay face down, not moving. The back of his big head, where it curved in to meet the neck, was a red crater. Ignoring her own wounds, which were gushing fresh scarlet out into the air, she turned the dwarf over. Where his right eye had been was a pit filled with blood. Marina Ryan looked up. Tears bubbled over the painted shelves of her lower lids and cut tracks through the makeup on her great cheeks as she cradled his ruptured head in her lap.
Oh, those bastards! That's one more to pay them for!
Grant had moved to secure the entry through which the mags had entered, with his shotgun at the ready, having reached wordlessly down to give Bridget a hand back to her feet.
You okay, Kane?
Kane was bent over, rubbing his chest where the bullet had hit.
Yeah, it just hurts like a son of a bitch.
No blood showed on his shirt. The shadow armor he wore beneath his clothes had kept the bullet from piercing his flesh. Unfortunately, it hadn't absorbed the whole impact.
Probably cracked a rib. Feels like a knife stabbing me every time I breathe. Damn.
We likely to have more company?
No.
She sat up with the lifeless Hanratty sprawled across her lap.
If there were more, they'd have landed on us already. Somebody found Mags, Harrington, and Ruiz here out on PPP and dropped a bug in their ears.
She had a pudgy hand pressed to her shoulder. Blood oozed out between her clutching fingers and down. Her capacious face had a greenish tint visible even through its layer of makeup. Bridget came to her side, but the huge woman waved her off.
Go. I'll be fine. It's just a flesh wound. And I've got a lot of flesh to spare.
She laid Hanratty tenderly back down on the rug, stood with effort, moved to her desk, where she pressed a hidden button.
Oh, somebody will come in a moment to guide you out. We can get you clear outside the walls without ever getting above the ground. This hellhole was built on top of the ruins of a pre-dark vill, like most of them. Us pitters have spent generations making a tunnel system out of sewers and basements.
Grant jerked his head at the dead mags cooling down and leaking under the threadbare throw rug.
What about them?
Leave them. My people will make them disappear. And then I'll make some mag bastards pay, starting with telling me who shopped me to these dung beetles. Now clear out of here. I can explain 2 dead maggots better than I can the live 3 of you.
As Maureen Orion's wound was bound, she told one of her lieutenants to guide them to the surface. It was the slim, black, gaudy slut Bridget had decked, currently sporting quite a mouse beneath one puffed-out eye. She grinned at Bridget.
That's quite a punch you got there.
Then she hefted a kerosene lantern and led off without further palaver. Their route took them through an up-and-down path like a mad, angular inchworm. As promised, it encompassed stairways, ramps, tunnels, basements, buried rooms, and ancient sewers. Some not so ancient, to judge by the smell. Where a dark stairway from above debouched onto the damp, tamped earth floor of a large basement lay the sprawled body of what appeared to be a middle-aged male pitter. More than that was hard to tell, since it had been beaten and stabbed almost shapeless. Recently, from the rich stench of fresh-voided bowels. Their guide nodded grimly at the sack-like corpse.
It brought the mags.
Pit justice.
Swift and certain.
Got to be.
As soon as they returned to the Cerberus Redoubt, Domi met them with a supreme look of distress.
Lakesh has been kidnapped!
Kidnapped?
Yes, by Aborigines. I wasn't even in the command center when it happened.
Who was?
Phil Boyd.
They gathered in the commissary in lieu of the giant main briefing chamber. The returned travelers had not yet even changed out of their disguises, although Kane had his shirt off and the top half of his shadow suit skinned down around his waist, so that a grim-faced Reba DeFore could bind his chest. The impact site still pained him when he breathed. Domi nodded at the lanky, bespectacled man sitting on the other side of the table from Kane.
Tell what happened!
Phil Boyd, the astrophysicist, one of the refugees from Menetius Moonbase, nodded his large, narrow head sagely.
We were monitoring your vital sign signals from your biolinks. Dr. Singh was just remarking that from the sudden spike in respiration and heartbeat, it appeared you three had managed to embroil yourself in another brawl.
A bar fight.
Phil Boyd didn't actually sniff, but looked as if he came that close.
We were so engrossed that we had no inkling anything might be amiss here, until the door burst open and a trio of men with wild hair and watch caps burst in. They shouted at us in harshly accented English not to move. I was so startled by the invasion that I was by reflex already in the process of standing up. My action appeared to provoke the invaders. One of them discharged some sort of hand weapon that surrounded him with a bluish nimbus and emitted an intolerably bright beam that shattered the environmental op station. I'm not used to situations like that. I should have been doing research, not being consigned to the control center, doing menial tasks better suited to a common technician.
Kane winced as DeFore snugged the wrapping tight with a touch more emphasis than necessary. She disapproved of him and Grant, from habit if nothing else.
Everybody takes their turns doing different jobs.
Except you, Grant, Domi, and Bridget.
Anytime you want my job, tough guy, you got it.
The gash scar on Phil Boyd's prominent forehead turned scarlet.
Gentlemen, this is not helping to get Lakesh back.
Do we want him back? That seems like a question worth addressing.
Of course we want him back. What kind of question is that?
Perfectly reasonable one by me. But let's hear the rest of the story. If people are popping up inexplicably inside Cerberus, that's interesting.
Both his companions on the just-ended Palladiumville mission glanced his way. Evidently, he didn't feel like sharing what they learned there with the semi-outsider Phil Boyd.
Done. Try to take a breather on getting banged up for a while, will you, Kane?
No. I'm just totally addicted to the feeling of getting smacked in the ribs by fucking bullets. It's such a rush.
The stocky, blonde, dreadlocked woman glared at him and marched out. Kane pulled the top half of his shadow suit back on.
Okay, Phil Boyd. Let's hear the thrilling climax.
There's not much else to tell. We offered no resistance under the circumstances. We had little choice. Even you can clearly see that, can't you? We really could not possibly have acted...
Save the elaborate self-justifications for your pillow and get on with it.
The intruder seized Dr. Singh and hustled him out the door, and then...
Let me guess. they vanished.
Into skinny air, with Lakesh!
Do you believe his captors were Australian Aborigines, Dr. Philboyd?
Bridget had taken to treating the Mooney physicist, who had made it repeatedly apparent that he had more than a passing interest in her, with all the cool correctness of a senior archivist. Brewster Philboyd simply shrugged.
I'm no ethnologist, but my impression, as well as that of the other people on duty at the time, was that they resembled Aboriginals. If only because we'd seen features on them on the Discovery Channel back before the new cost.
What about their speech? Did they have Australian accents?
Would they? But when you, Domi, and Shizuka got back, you mentioned that the vision they showed you had the whites getting pretty well wiped out during the new cost.
It did. It has occurred to me subsequently that, like much of the vision, it may have been intended more as allegory than a portrayal of literal truth. For example, I doubt strongly that any Anunnaki were literally transformed into outcroppings.
I don't know. That punishment process Majira had for sinners turned them into something a whole lot like Black Rock statues.
Be that as it may.
Did the guy you spoke to have an Australian accent?
Kane looked to Domi, who shrugged. The diminutive albino woman, Outlands-born and bred, had no reference for what such an accent might sound like.
He most likely did. It stands to reason. Even if the European-descended Australians were totally or substantially exterminated by the nuke cost and its aftermath, if English were still spoken by the Aborigines, it would presumably be descended from that dialect.
If you'll permit me to answer, inasmuch as I was present for the incident in question, yes, the kidnappers did speak with Australian accents, and yes, I am familiar with such accents.
I still don't see what use Australian Aborigines would have for Lakesh, but if they do, they're welcome to him as far as I'm concerned.
You don't mean that.
Yes, I do.
You're the one who keeps talking about retiring from the game. Does this mean you're willing to take over direction of operations against the hybrids?
Grant looked sour.
A scary thought all around.
Kane pushed at his ribs gingerly through the wrapping Defoe had placed on them, now concealed beneath his shadow armor.
Still hurts like fire. But it looks as if I'm going to Australia anyway.
Have you looked at a map recently? Australia is the largest sort of place.
Uluru, good place to start, no?
Makes sense. That's where this new quantum space interference originates from. And if I remember correctly from your earlier jaunt, it's the big holy place for the Aborigines. Isn't that likely where they'd have taken him?
You go. I stay home.
Everybody looked at her.
But you've been there before.
Sure have.
Something was clearly distressing her. She was reverting to the clipped speech of her Outlands upbringing.
Aborigines got some spooky powers. They pissed off at us, want no part of them, big time.
She has a point, Kane. They did indeed display remarkable abilities to us, including ample evidence that they might be able to exert such mastery over the space-time continuum as to account for the intrusions into the Baronies and Cerberus. I find myself disturbed as well as perplexed. The Aborigines are doing things that seem to run counter to the way they dealt with us before. While they didn't leave us abundant choice as to whether to help them against Erica Van Sloan and Baron Beausoleil, they seemed well disposed toward us for doing so, even though it was, after all, what we had gone to Australia to do. But they seemed to have completely restored their traditional culture, including language and dress. The descriptions of the intruders, including the ones that came to Cerberus, all portray them wearing contemporary Western clothes and speaking English. And these mysterious energy beam weapons.
Maybe this is some other faction of Aborigines.
They didn't seem too prone to factionalization when we were there.
Everybody's got factions, Baptiste.
Kane looked pointedly at Philboyd. The astrophysicist's pitted cheeks colored.
If you were insinuating...
This is Brian, the command center. You all better get up here right away. We've got a communication coming in from Lakesh.
It is customary to abase oneself when addressing the living god.
Sprawled on a throne of silken cushions and marble, the god-king may have chosen, for unfathomable reasons, to present himself in a setting barbaric even by apekin standards, but he still had baronial guards, these naked to the waist, wearing scarlet turbans wrapped tightly about their heads, and with extravagant curved swords thrust through the scarlet sashes they wore over spotless white pantaloons. A pair closed in on either side as if to lay hands upon the guest who stood before him.
If only the other barons could see what is befalling me.
Baron Thulia's cheeks burned with humiliated anger and more than a touch of fear. Then, as he dropped hastily to his knees, At least there was a gilt-edged crimson carpet laid on the steps up the dais to ease his frail knees. It occurred to him that this might have been precisely what his brother barons, and that presumptuous apekin she-devil Erica Van Sloan, might have had in mind. At the very least, he knew to a bitter certainty, lowering his head like a common human in obeisance to the Dewa Raja of Tanimbar, that their primary action would be, better you than us.
Achoo.
A calico cat walked before him, swaying its rump like a gaudy slut. Its tail trickled loathsomely across his face. It was like a steam room within the secret throne chamber. A shaved-headed male slave, small, brown, gnarled, and naked but for a loincloth, worked a silken cord that led to the ceiling, over a pulley, and thence to a complicated but decidedly low-tech reciprocating drive that worked a ceiling fan. The fan itself, a giant kite-like assembly of bamboo and what appeared to be faded colored paper, did stir the air in the fashion of a paddle churning dense, muddy water. Dense, muddy, hot water.
You may arise and be welcome, Baron Thulia.
With difficulty, Thulia stood. His mouth was filled with sourness, and his nose ran with snot in a most undignified manner. The capital city of this bizarre and bizarrely unlooked-for baron, a hybrid of his own class, whose existence he had never so much suspected until the despicable Van Sloan creature briefed him prior to his jump, was called Kuching, which meant cat. And cats there were in mad profusion. Cat frescoes staring from the walls. Cat tapestries. Carved cinnabar cats taller than Thulia himself flanking the throne. And, of course, the actual, repulsive, incessantly shedding beasts themselves, to which the Baron was violently allergic. The baronial guards had resumed their posts near marble columns twined with apparently living vines. Thulia felt a prickling, slightly stinging flush in his thin cheeks that had nothing to do with the temperature within the room, histamine reaction, and possibly not even with his fury at being treated in such manner.
Have I already contracted some beastly contagion in this egregious pest hole? I've barely been here half an hour.
Your Majesty, I have come to...
You have come to Tanimbar to direct our efforts to ensure that they are conducted according to the liking of your fellows in North America. We are quite aware. You may draw nearer, cousin.
Clamping down a scowl, Thulia did. As he came closer, mounting the wide, low base of the dais itself, he felt cool air wafting from the direction of the throne.
The duplicitous bastard! He's got a refrigeration unit built into the thing!
His small mouth sphinctered into near invisibility as a pair of human servants brought forth a chair for him. Glancing around, he momentarily froze with something more like horror than he thought himself capable of. The servants were small, stocky, dark-skinned, and black-haired, like most of the admittedly few apekin he had encountered since jumping into the palace of the god king. But they differed in one terrifying respect. Instead of eyes, they had concave membranes over obviously empty sockets. Nor was there any sign of surgical alteration, such as sewing the lid closed. To all appearances, the skin of their faces had grown that way, stretched over cavities, like blind cavefish. He realized the servant plying the fan was the same. They placed the chair precisely, then withdrew, their bare soles making only the slightest wisps of sound upon the polished cinnabar of the floors and the carpets laid down upon them.
Yes, all my body servants are that way. A simple genetic alteration. I make use of many biofacts as servitors. These sightless ones, gilled fishmen to patrol my harbors, 7-foot-tall manslayers with 4 arms and red skin. The key, beyond my own convenience, is awe. You of North America rely upon your gleaming white castles and your black-armored legions with their firearms, fighting vehicles, and helicopters to instill awe into your subjects. Despite your access to an overall higher level of technology than my modest kingdom, it derives, with only minor if key enhancements, from that of late 20th century America. It is, of course, because you have but limited resources of the higher art at your disposal.
A smell of incense, alien, sweet, incisive, was carving its way through thick air and nasal mucus and into Baron Thulia's sensorium like a subtle scalpel. The light of tropical morning sun, which Thulia was grateful he had not yet had to confront directly, slanted in through angled slots in the ceiling, producing a soft luminance in the chamber that was almost liquid itself. He became gradually aware of music playing faintly. He felt his head nodding, blinked rapidly to clear the fog from his brain.
Is the bastard trying to hypnotize me?
When we journeyed to these islands almost a century ago, we likewise possessed some advanced tools and much advanced knowledge. But unlike you, we did not have the mighty North American industrial base to draw upon. Even after the devastation of the Megaco and 2 centuries of aftermath, great and even relatively accessible resources remained for you to salvage during the building of your baronies. Not so for us exiles. The empire to which these islands belonged, the so-called Republic of Indonesia, had industrial technology only slightly behind that of your North American antecedents. But it was more centralized, and accordingly more easily neutralized. Indeed, most of it was wiped out of existence, a far greater proportion than North America lost. Whereas you suffered catastrophic damage to the western extreme of your continent, these islands received the effects of the Soviet Earthshaker devices salted along the Pacific Rim far more directly. The eruptions, the quakes, the tsunami they engendered, especially the explosion of a supervolcano beneath what was once the island of Rabaul, simply scoured most of the islands bare, not only of life, but of most of even the most enduring of industrial works. Whereas many shops and factories remained for your exploitation even a century after the new cost, most of what base these islands had was simply eradicated. Even the foundations were swept away, as if they had never been.
He paused to sip from his golden skull. Thulia could definitely see condensation on its contoured surface now. It was doubtless self-chilled as well. The low-tech appearance of this semi-inner sanctum was just that, appearance, down to the stultifying heat and humidity that would only affect visitors. Beyond that, the only words Thulia could summon to describe it were barbaric splendor. The throne of polished marble, the lustrous deep red floor, the vine-twined pillars of marble, the great fleshy fronded plants flanking the throne, the rich carpets, the censers smoldering on their skinny stands, the omnipresent cats, all could have belonged to a throne room centuries or even millennia before. Nothing visible or even perceptible clashed with that impression, unless one were close enough and as perceptive as Baron Thulia. It's not just to evoke awe, he realized with a sudden insight flash. He enjoys this. Somehow that realization made him as uneasy at the sense of being altogether at the mercy of another being, a being whom everything he had known throughout his life argued should not exist. The hybrids as a whole made much of their incapacity to feel. Emotion was a messy, chaotic thing. Emotion was what made it impossible for the apekin ever to rise above the level of savages, of animals. Hybrids were creatures of the intellect, their minds far more powerful than those of mere humans, their feelings subjugated both by their innate qualities and by disciplined thought. The barons, as the highest form of hybrid, were supposed to be the most rational and unemotional of all. Baron Thulia, on the other hand, was high-strung, positively skittish. He had originally thought himself a freak, had desperately feared, itself an emotion supposedly holding little sway over hybrids, far less barons, discovery that he was tainted, and so would be expunged by his fellows. Over the years, he had come to harbor ever less furtive suspicions that all was not as he himself believed it ought to be. He gradually became aware of quirks within his fellow psyches. It was nothing overt. A comment made during their regular rejuvenation sessions in the base beneath Archuleta Mesa, odd tidbits of demeanor or reaction during councils, gossip concerning peculiar behavior. In the past few years, what had been hints became blazingly obvious. It all seemed to have sprung from, or at least been catalyzed by, Baron Cobalt losing control over his own minions, with the result that 3 key underlings went rogue. Since then, everything had gone to pieces, including, quite literally, the Archuleta Mesa facility itself, destroyed when the wretched Cobaltville renegades crashed an Aurora craft into it. Outright baronial eccentricities had been driven into the open. The megalomania of Baron Cobalt, the odd obsession with enjoying carnal knowledge of apekin women that consumed Baron Ragnar, Baron Sharp's delusion of immortality. Yet while Thulia now knew he was not unique in being subject to certain mental weaknesses, he could not combat the dread that he was the most afflicted among the survivors, and that those weaker than he had already succumbed. Doing the opposite of allaying those fears was the fact that his was the smallest and, frankly, least consequential barony of the nine. Consisting of what had been considered New England, his domain had once contained one of the greatest concentrations of population and wealth in the United States, which meant of the entire globe. Unfortunately, that had made it a prime Soviet target in the nuke cost. So Thulia ruled over a tiny territory with a minute population that was, however, rich in ruins, mostly still lethal hot zones, quite beyond useful exploitation. Smallest and weakest, though his barony unmistakably was, one advantage had come into play since the breakdown of Unity. Thuliaville alone was not surrounded by rivals, potential or actual. His domain adjoined only Sharpeville, plus regions of what had been eastern Canada reclaimed by wilderness, which, so far as Thulia and the other barons were concerned, was welcome to them. If he lacked the buffer around his baronial ville provided the other barons by the enormous territories they ruled, he also lacked the enormous problems entailed in ruling such sprawls, a fact that the other barons had pressed upon him as the prime reason he should be the one to undertake the mission to the South Seas to cut out the heart of whatever evil was infiltrating the very fastnesses of the barons. He, simply, had less to risk by his absence, since his small territory was, almost paradoxically, least vulnerable either to attack from without or internal disorder. He might have played one final card, that the most suitable emissary would be the mere human Erica Van Sloan, de facto Baron of Cobaltville or not. In part, he had not done so because of his dread of his own inadequacies. Despite the fact Van Sloan was a mere human, even if of greatly superior gifts, and consequently inferior to any hybrid, much less that crowning glory of assisted evolutionary progress known as a baron, he was flat afraid of her. She intimidated him. He knew he was not alone in that, and Van Sloan enjoyed, after all, the patronage of her son, Sam, who, if temporarily thwarted in his quest to make himself imperator first of North America and then Earth, was still a force of unknown nature and unplumbed but horrific potency. All barons feared her cunning and her malevolence, human or not, and even more, they feared Sam. That, finally, had been what prevented Thulia from pressing a case that Erica, not himself, should be dispatched like a servant to dance attendance upon this barbarian baron in the southern hemisphere. He didn't trust her. At least, when she was at home in Cobaltville, she was more or less contained as anybody could be who could jump at will to 100 locations on Earth's surface and beyond, including to the fallen Imperator's sulking spot by the Great Pyramid outside the ruins of Shan in China. Whereas, who knew what mischief she might get up to unleashed far beyond the boundaries of North America and any sensible ability of her fellow barons to keep tabs on her? Especially inasmuch as she alone, except for presumably her demon offspring, had known of the very existence not just of other colonies of hybrids upon Earth, but of other baronies, such as this savage satrapy in the South Pacific Islands.
You have the advantage of me, O God King. Achoo! Evidently you have long been aware of the existence of the nine baronies of North America. Yet until the last few days, I and most of my fellow North American barons were entirely unaware of yours.
Perhaps the information you and your fellow barons of North America have been given has been as carefully managed and measured as what you yourselves choose to tell your own human cattle.
Thulia felt his cheeks burn. He had subconsciously resisted acknowledging what was an all but self-evident fact. Irrationally, he hated the strange baron for forcing him to confront it.
You believed you were quite alone, did you not? That you were the only hybrids on Earth. Yet there were other colonies of us scattered across the planet. Perhaps all were founded by fugitives such as myself. Perhaps some were seeded as part of a deliberate policy, and the knowledge of one another's existence just as deliberately kept from them. Who knows? We exist. We are not as powerful as you of North America. Even as I have said, our technological base is not so wide and deep as yours. For that reason, if no other, we have been assiduous in keeping our existence secret from you. But now, with the onset of troubling events in Australia, we have allowed you to learn of our existence.
But why? Why not deal with the situation yourselves, or simply lie low and allow us to confront the problem without revealing yourselves?
The God King nodded smilingly.
Wise questions. The answer is simple. We fear.
Thulia blinked his exceptionally large and limpid blue-green eyes. He knew fear too well. He knew also what the other hybrids feared, even other barons. They feared loss of power, feared loss of access to the technologies that kept them alive, feared most of all the brutish lusts and unthinking passions of the apekin. Yet it was rare for one to admit it so baldly. He moistened his lips with his tiny, pale pink tongue.
Fear what, Your Majesty?
The strange baron leaned forward and spoke one word.
Uluru.
Uluru?
Thulia blinked. It took him a moment to recall that Van Sloan had spoken of the thing. An immense boulder, sacred to the peculiar subspecies who had been manifesting themselves so mysteriously in the baronial strongholds.
I don't understand.
You will. It is a threat potentially so great as to endanger the dominion of our people over the ape kind. Therefore, I have chosen that we should work together to put an end to it. By my command, an invasion force and a fleet to carry it assemble upon the island of Tanimbar to the south and east of here. Tomorrow I sail to join that fleet, finalize my preparations, and then put paid to the savages and their magical rock for good and all. And to possess myself of the powers of Uluru itself, a task at which even Erica Van Sloan and Baron Beausoleil failed.
Thulia blinked his eyes more rapidly. The creature was either deluded, lying to him, or knew something else Thulia himself had no inkling of.
But I shall not fail. And because you have come to assist me, I shall graciously share the bounty of our conquest with you.
For some reason, a jocular vulgarism from his own Vil's Tartarus pits tolled like a bell within Baron Thulia's mind.
When pigs grow wings...
Brigid stared at the large communicator screen.
Lakesh, you're alive!
Seated within what appeared to be a tent, Lakesh frowned.
Why would I not be alive? I was abducted, not assassinated.
He turned to an aged Aboriginal man with a short frizz of snow-white hair covering his round head, who sat across a small camp table from him. He wore a khaki shirt.
Yes, thank you. I would like more tea, if you please.
The elderly man smiled benignly and nodded to a young man standing by, who refilled Lakesh's cup from a brass teapot.
They're giving you a break from the whips and chains, is that it?
Don't be more obtuse than necessary, Kane. The Aborigines have no whips and chains. Surely the account of our female friend showed you they are not like that at all.
I also know that every culture has its subgroups and factions, some of them outlaws who do not follow the same rules as the overculture.
These are indeed the same people you dealt with before. The Anangu branch of the Arernte group. Uluru lies just beyond the flap of this very tent.
Where's Yindi?
Domi was referring to the middle-aged aborigine who had escorted the three women through a personalized presentation of Jukurpa, the Dreamtime, as well as debriefed them for their attack to free the pregnant Quavel from Erica, Baron Beausoleil, and their henchmen.
He is busy about his affairs. I can ask Old Man to summon him if it would make you more comfortable.
I'd also observe that kidnapping you wasn't altogether consistent with the impression we received of Yindi and his people.
The Cerberus director seemed in an unusually waspish frame of mind. Perhaps he was not expecting to be greeted by a barrage of questions.
Why not? He kidnapped you initially, didn't he? Diverting you on a jump, no less. In any event, I am not a prisoner at all, as you can clearly see. That was all a misunderstanding.
Yeah, a bunch of these dudes accidentally happened to materialize out of thin air and zap our environmental ops workstation. Then, when they realized where they were and what they'd done, they hightailed it home, equally accidentally dragging you with them. Imagine their surprise. Hell, it could happen to anybody.
Lakesh's blue eyes blazed furiously, either side of his thin nose. His companion leaned farther into the picture.
Perhaps you could introduce me to your charming friends, Doctor.
yes, of course. Old man, these are my associates, Dr. Brigid Baptiste, Dr. Brewster Filboid. The tiny, exquisitely pale creature with the ruby eyes is Domi. The large one is Grant, and the lean, somewhat sarcastic one is Kane. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the old man.
Old man? Is that a name or a title?
It is whatever you wish it to be, friend Kane. Old man, old guy, old Abbo, the elder. Call me anything you like. Only don't call me late for supper.
Great. Another pushy old guy.
With even older jokes.
Ignore their badinage, old man. It's their way of covering for their insecurities.
Watch that. Now, the next time we happen to be in the same room, I might just...
Don't try my patience, Grant.
Oh, will you two stop wagging your weenies at each other and get to the damn story?
Why, certainly, Domi, my sweet. I'm so sorry to have distressed you. In short, old man directed his associates to abduct me because of sheer misunderstanding.
That produced nothing but silence among the listeners in Cerberus. This made Lakesh smile.
For some time, old man has been monitoring electronic communications worldwide, including North America. Apparently, some of his capabilities are quite sophisticated, because his people have eavesdropped on baronial traffic and even some of our own.
Impossible.
I would have thought so too, Bri, dear boy. I also thought it impossible for normal human beings to teleport themselves without the use of any external equipment whatsoever. Be that as it may, listen in, they did. But their penetration of our communications was less than perfect. Among other things, they derived the impression that I was still working for the benefit of the so-called Archon Directorate.
He posed a possible threat to us, but he knew more about the Totality concept and the Archon Directorate and its schemes than any human alive. And also, because his unparalleled knowledge of physics might prove of use to us in our current endeavor.
Kane felt his eyes narrow at the way old man said human. Unquestionably, he knew more than a little about the true nature of Earth's self-appointed masters, including the fact that the Archon Directorate itself was a scam. He turned to the red-haired archivist.
These are the same people you and Domi and Shizuka saw dancing around campfires, wearing mostly red and yellow paint, Baptiste?
Bridget could only shrug helplessly.
What we told you was what we experienced. You can ask Domi or Shizuka if you doubt me.
Once again, Sally Wright raised her hand before speaking.
Perhaps they use different technologies for different applications. The traditional practice, including dream time, when it works best. Modern science, when that seems called for.
She cringed her head into the collar of her jumpsuit as everybody turned to look at her.
Sorry for speaking out of place. I know I'm a newcomer here.
Makes as much sense as anything else I've heard so far.
Sally has hit upon the gist of it. You must understand, my friends, what is happening is nothing less than that the Australian Aborigines are recovering racial memories lost for millennia.
Tens of millennia.
Irritation barely flickered across Lakesh's face.
At least we'll get some entertainment out of watching these two try to upstage each other.
I beg your pardon, Grant. Did you have some comment you wish to share?
Just clearing my throat.
Lakesh's desire to hold forth won a quick victory over any inclination he may have had to press issues.
What is happening is tremendously exciting. Not even I can grasp the full ramifications of it all. I can tell you that old man has utterly convinced me to throw the whole weight of Cerberus and its resources behind him and his people.
That's big of you to commit all our time and energy and lives and little things like that.
I understand your resentment, friend Kane, of what must seem, from your perspective, to be even more than my customary high-handedness. But you must also realize there is a terrible threat hanging over our heads and all of humanity. The hybrids even now assemble an invasion force in the Scific Islands north of Australia to capture Uluru. Should they come into possession of its secrets, the consequences would be disastrous. Those secrets would give an untold boost to their goal of subjugating humankind without hope of redemption.
Secrets? Secrets not even Erica Van Sloan found in weeks of work inside Uluru?
The very secrets she sought, Dr. Baptiste. But they were not available then, when my new friend Yindi called upon your help, and which you and your friend so generously gave.
What secrets are those?
Kane judged that Domi didn't understand what was going on here, and it was making her peevish. Lakesh assumed a look of ineffable smugness.
Think, dearest Domi, if we told you, they wouldn't be secrets any longer.
She turned and stamped out of the room.